Welcome to Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. I'm Phil McKenzie.
I'm Michael Brooks.
On Point is where we highlight someone getting it right. And we're joined today by Andrea Bell, Director of Insight at WGSN. How are you?
Good. How are you? Thank you for having me.
I'm very happy that I said your name correctly.
I did right off the bat.
Because most of the time when I see the name written as is spelled, I always default to Andrea.
Yeah. Well, it's pronounced so many different ways. I get stopped Andrea, Andrea. Andrea. I'm kind of like, as long as it's close,
Andrea.
We're good. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not your name.
No.
That's a new one for me.
Well, there you go. Take that with you. Again, trend forecasting right there.
Yeah. Perfect way to
out the gate.
We're running. So why don't you give us a sense of a little bit of background on who you are, how you came to the work of insight and trend forecasting and just broad strokes so our listeners get a better sense of who Andrea is.
Perfect. I actually started off in journalism, so that was kind of my big venture. My first ever piece written was groundbreaking. It was for Cosmo Girl and it was about velvet bodysuits. Wow.
Oh, Matt was into that stuff for a while.
So really
velvet bodysuits. Yeah. I'm trying to place when that would have been.
That picture, early 2000s.
Early
aughts coming in strong. And then ever since then, so that was kind of my big
forte. What's the content? Like, what do you do with them?
Get it. It was a trend piece. It was a fashion trend piece.
Right,
again, really, really used that college degree where I thought I was going to be writing this hard hitting journalism facts. And of course, as any young journalist will tell you, you'll basically do anything to get a byline. And that was kind of my first foray was
velvet
bodysuits. Great pick.
What is that? Velvet?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I actually wasn't even thinking Coming to America. I was literally thinking of Velvet Jones. It was like, you remember Velvet Jones?
Or I was thinking Black Velvet, the song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
There's many good Velvet
like,
references.
Ladies, would you like to earn a living without leaving the comfort of your own bedroom? That's
Janet
that's
Jackson's
classic
Velvet
right there.
Rope.
Velvet Rope.
There's a lot of good
Velvet Rope. Jones.
Okay, let's not digress.
Yes. Okay. Whoa. Sorry.
So,
sorry. We took it.
Back to the transition from the journalism bylines
So journalism byline, then was my minor was cross-cultural studies. I was always kind of fascinated by shifts, especially consumer shifts, and behavioral shifts in people. What makes certain subgroups do certain things? Why? What is the call to action? And from there, I started working at WGSN after a long journalism career. And I was based in LA and part of the retail and analysis team. And then it became part of the in-house think tank team, which is something WGSN started. And then we sectioned that off in October of last year to WGSN Insights. So we are known for our fashion forecasting, which that's what most people associate WGSN with. But we have now in October launched an insight platform, which is all kind of consumer behavior, data analytics, and kind of melding, as we say, the maths and magic. Love a good buzzword at WGSN. We do.
I love buzzwords.
I like them if I create them.
Yeah. if you know what they mean.
Yeah. But I like that you say that though, math and magic. I do actually like that buzzword because I mean, one of the things that Phil and I are always talking about on the show or when we're working with clients or when we're speaking, whatever, is one, there's the kind of oppositional position, which is that like quantitative insights are important for certain things, but they're not going to save you. Mm-hmm. And this kind of obsession with data, especially if you're trying to like, figure out something that people are going to, they're lying to you if they're telling you that there's a quantitative solution for a cultural question, right? So, that's, you know, part of our argument. And then more broadly, we're kind of arguing for an integrative approach to figuring out things like brands' relationship to culture or, you know, anticipating movements or things like that. So when you talk about the approach that you guys have, I mean, and I think that now we've noticed like in the last year, this kind of shift where people used to push back and be like, no, your data is great. You don't get it. Yeah. And now, especially like with what happened in the election, there's a lot more like, oh yeah, we need it to be integrative, but most people still aren't. Yeah. You guys have been. So what does it actually look like in practice to really have that kind of integrative, holistic framework for mapping this stuff in a field where there's so many variables, so much bullshit, and so much complexity?
I mean, that's one of the things that at WGSN, well, and we personally do on our forecast team is, you know, there's the STEAM model, which I'm sure you guys are familiar with. And that's a very traditional, forecast analysis. So you look at social, technology, environmental, education, and then obviously political. We add a third E, and that's emotion. And this isn't a sales pitch. So what we've noticed is everyone talks about, oh, consumer, you know, engagement. We need to look at data. We need to look at millennials. What are millennials buying? How are Gen X shopping? That's a huge subset of people, especially in the U.S. alone. So what we are really, really, you know, we call it almost a feelings forecast. We also want to know, what is the emotion? What is the mood? Is it empathy? Is it anxiety? Is it fear? And then if you can narrow it down, that's how you can figure out how you as a brand can effectively communicate without going tone deaf.
How do you measure that?
Well, it depends. It depends on, you know, it's certain factors. So for instance, if it's specifically for the US, you know, we ask a variety of questions, but the first would be, you know, don't just say millennials. What does success actually look like for you? What do you want to do? Do you want to inspire? Is this supposed to be inspirational? Is it supposed to be educational? What is the conversation you want to have with a single person? And I think where a lot of brands get it wrong is they look at everything as a massive market segment. And in reality, everyone is a segment of one now because of a smartphone. So, you know, the one size fits all approach does not work. So when we're narrowing it down, once we can define what does success look like for you, then we can kind of do an emotion map. Okay. So if you're really talking to someone, you want to hit 21 to 24 in an authentic way, you know, what are their top priorities? You know, is it fear right now? Are they anxious because they don't have job opportunities? Is it suburban flight? Is it urban, you know, integration? And it's different for every client truly, but that's how we map it out. I mean, you can, just to your point, there's data every day. We are drowning in data, you know, so how do you cut through that clutter and actually do something with it?
Do you find clients are receptive to that sort of approach? You know, part of my experience in a past life prior to the show and our work that we do is that clients sometimes don't want to hear hard truths.
Yeah.
You know, have you hit moments of that sort of resistance in your work?
We have. And I know from your background doing so much content creation and kind of advertising, I'm sure you've been in a lot of those meetings where you just want to say you need to start from zero.
Yeah, and they don't like to start from
zero.
No,
they don't. And it also depends on who's on that board as well. I mean, I hate to generalize, but we work with some clients who get it right away and want to kind of say, you know, how can we pivot? And then we have some which say the same phrase, which is the most dangerous phrase. Like, well, we've always done it this way. So why would we change it? And it's like, well, you're the one who's losing sales. You're the ones who's closing stores. You've got more to lose than me, you know? So what, you know, sometimes it is having that conversation. They have to be receptive though. And that's a chain of command issue, not necessarily a one-on-one.
Yeah. It's interesting you bring up the clients who are having like the obvious problems. Mm-hmm. How do you find clients are receptive to hearing feedback when they're not having obvious problems? For example, things are going well, but there might be to the point about the future forecasting, yeah, there might be issues that they're not identifying that are that you guys might see, yeah, as being super important, but they're like,
well, we're doing great.
Yeah, we're doing fine.
Yeah.
Sales are up, you know, we're the most talked about. Blah, blah, yeah, you know, cause in our experience, you know, people fall off cliffs.
Yeah.
You know, Nokia was once the biggest mobile provider in the world.
Yeah.
And the end came quickly.
Very quickly.
For them.
Drastic.
Yeah.
I think there's a difference. I think smart companies are always trying to, what we say, future proof. And, you know, just cause you can sit there in your earnings meetings and brag about your Q3 and Q4 sales, you know, how are you actually going to maintain that? And it's fascinating because we always say, you know, is this a reactionary move or is this a planned move? Some brands are tanking and they have to react and they come to us just for almost certitude, basically saying, you know, where do we go from here and how can we keep the growth? And some it's the complete opposite, where we're trying to say you are doing really well right now, but what does this look like in 2 or 3 years from now? Especially, you know, when you look at the speed of mobile, when you look at the speed of connection, when you look at consumers' attention span, I mean, it's 8 seconds now. It's 8 seconds. And to have that quick engagement in 8 seconds is massive. And then it's predicted by 2020, it'll be 6 seconds. So think about that. You know, you have to grab someone's attention in a sea of advertising, in a sea of, you know, constant notifications and pings. And by 2020, you'll have 6 seconds to do it. So that's where you need to be thinking. You know, don't think just now, okay, we've got a great Insta campaign. You know, it's been retweeted a million times. Like, what does that actually look like in 2020 and beyond?
This sounds to me like when people used to have the old advertising, like 12 second abs.
Yeah.
And then they'd say, like, the only thing better than that is 11 second abs.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm always curious when I hear those kind of numbers, because I don't know if I spend like 8 seconds. These numbers sound so quick to me. And I find, like, how does one, like, what does that really mean, that people are looking at something for that long, or
that people will actively have focus on what you're staring at for 8 seconds in terms of a stream, in terms of a stream on your phone? So if right now, if we were scrolling Instagram, I'd have 8 seconds and be like, okay, that shot. Great. And the other thing that's interesting that ties in with kind of the 8 second attention span is visual language. And that's something that I think is extremely important that a lot of people don't talk about, is the rise of visual language. And as a, you know, journalist and an avid reader, the biggest book nerd, I read an hour each day. It kills me, but it's true. It's like visual language is rising. And one of the things that we always say is, how do you stand out? If you look at Instagram right now, if all of us pulled up our phones, chances are we're going to have so many similar images on our phone. A girl holding an ice cream cone at a beach, someone jumping. You know, there's.
Oh, I don't like the jump.
Not my friend's Instagram.
Yeah.
I'm not on Instagram, but my crew's Instagram don't look like people holding ice cream.
Okay. But have you guys heard of airspace effect? Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it's a restaurant in New York looks like a restaurant in LA, looks like a restaurant in Paris because of cultural homogenization.
Right.
That's true. I mean, when's the last time we always joke around and say avocado toast, succulents, and millennial pink? It's everywhere.
Do you think there's obviously a lot of truth to what you're saying, but what I wonder is, when we talk about even like an idea like future proofing, because we were talking before we went on air about how Phil and I are pretty dubious about just even the word futurist or futurism. And it always struck, because, you know, there's different types of future. Like, some people call themselves futurists, but basically they're just kind of writing about general trends and maybe making some extrapolations, and you can agree or disagree and, you know, fine, whatever. There's other people that are doing, in my opinion, just like secular or technical logical versions of like religious divination. And I think tarot card reading is more interesting than Silicon Valley fantasies, you know, but that's just me personally. And then, you know, but then I think the most compelling is if people who are, you know, in some ways, if you're extrapolating the present, what you really can do is drive some really deep insight about what's happening now through doing a cultural antenna function. Like, that's what art can do, right? Like, you watch a movie several years ago, like, you know, now everybody got hip all of a sudden to Children of Men again, because that movie anticipated a lot of themes that were already there, but now they're kind of more
Brazil.
One of my recent picks. Yeah. Brazil, Children of Men, all of that. So there's like this antenna function. And I think that we start to, you know, I guess there's two questions out of that. It's like, okay, so right now in this moment, there's cultural homogeneity. There's really short attention spans. Does that mean though, down the road, there is there a backlash of 2020? Yeah. Is there like the countervailing force so that like what you're starting to anticipate is people are getting sick of being in that position so that we can use it to potentially say like, this makes the present more clear. And then maybe it gives us non-typical senses of the future because people might start getting contrarian about all this stuff.
And there's always a counterbalance to it. I mean, for everyone that is on five platforms and constantly tweeting, you know, there's a huge movement behind it that's not, and that's kind of stepping off. I do think we don't want to generalize, but there are certain things we're tracking. For instance, Gen Alpha, which is, you know, 2010 and above. They're the most quantified generation. Think about it. You know, their parents take photos of them. I mean, this is my baby's the size of an eggplant now, and my baby sleeps 15 hours a day, and yay.
Brief editorial. Stop sharing pictures of your kids.
But it's true. So that you have this generation that's coming up that has been quantified since birth. So we anticipate some sort of a backlash. Yes, they're completely sound in technology. You know, they have, you know, techno tantrums at 3. 3, you can see the effects of on-screen time. But, you know, I can't imagine a kid at 4 who has grown up in a world where he's constantly connected and quantified. At some point, he's going to want to turn off. Right. And he's going to appreciate even more kind of real life experiences. And that kind of goes into the, you know, the phase of the experience economy. But it's really about meaning and finding meaning.
Is there a difference between being things being quantified and things being shared, in the sense that, you know, I was at my parents' house a few weeks ago. I don't remember why, but I was. And
better have a good explanation.
Yeah, I was going to say, because maybe just good son visiting.
Yeah.
What the fuck were you doing at your
But I've been there a lot lately. So I was trying to remember specifically what brought me there that particular weekend. But like the last 4 weekends has been at their crib. Yeah. But anyway.
We'll let it slide.
Yeah. You know, parents.
Yeah. I mean, look.
But
well, you won't catch me hanging out with my parents.
You know, yeah. Like, damn them. You know, but we spent a lot of time, like, looking at, like, old photo albums and old pictures and stuff. And so I feel like, in a sense, we have those things, but they're just not in the ability to be shared. You know, like, they're in a photo album book as opposed to Instagram or Facebook or however people are sharing kind of images and videos and things like that. So, is there a difference in the behavior versus the way in which that behavior is being, like, used in the public sphere?
I think it's a little both. I think, you know, every generation, everybody has nostalgia and you long for that. So, you know, sitting down and looking at photos of your grandparents or looking at photos of you as a child, that's, you know, is nothing to do tied to technology. To your point, you still enjoyed it. It still was an experience for you. I think what's happened majorly since, you know, the internet is, of course, all that is at the palm of your hand now. So people are more prone to share. And then if you, you know, there's another segment with this that if you actually think about how, you know, we've changed in terms of our creative lives and our work lives, that affects your ability to share and communicate. So if people are moving more, you know, maybe they can't go home for the weekend and see pictures of their grandparents. But if mom posts it, I get to see what my grandparents looked like on Father's Day or Mother's Day or whatever. So I think it's the intention, the actual emotion of nostalgia is still there, but it's the way that we can absorb it and how quick we can access it now. I mean, if we were sitting in this room and you said, oh, let me show you a photo of my grandmother, you know, 20 years ago, we wouldn't have been able to do that. But now I can see a photo of your grandmother and your grandfather.
I don't have any pictures of my grandparents.
Maybe somewhere on your loser. Facebook.
Yeah, you're crazy.
We're not visiting our parents. Yeah, yeah, we're not family-oriented.
What's the matter with you? Yeah.
Huh. You guys are missing out.
I might be a late-end millennial, but I'm still a millennial, and I don't associate my family. I just want to apologize to my family that's listening. It's all a comedic trope.
Yeah. They're going to sit there and be like, no wonder he doesn't come home for the holidays. He doesn't want to see photos of us.
Yeah, I don't want to see the photos. I don't want to document it.
Yeah.
You know, Michael mentioned this, that, you know, we're both kind of skeptics of futurism, what have you. And, you know, my personal issue is there seems to be a complete lack of accountability in the sense that I would love to go back over the last decade and look at all of these futurists and all the things they predicted and see how much of it actually happened. You know, and you know, you guys have a new paper coming out, Future Proofing the Brand.
Yeah.
You know, like, what can you share with us about sort of the genesis of why you guys took on this paper and what are some, like, of the direction that you're seeing formulate? I know we're a few weeks away from it being released.
I think, you know, back to the futurist thing. I mean, I think there are some people that, you know, claim to be futurists and it's basically ideation, right? You know, they're sitting in a room, they're reading a lot and they're ideating. So if we know that, you know, Elon Musk is investing in solar, it's going to be, you know, in 5 years, we'll be transporting, you know, so that's that type of futurism, which is still needed and helpful. And it sparks creative exchange, makes for a great TED talk. You know, you love a good futurist, mainly from an inspirational standpoint. I think we really try to make it, you know, again, not to sound like a sales tag. I'm not in content, but it has to be informational. So we really look at factors now culturally that will impact. One of the big ones for us was athleisure. And this is just a prime example of it. our active editor, Claire Varga, called that in 2008, and it was based on her own research of more people are urbanizing. They're not riding in their cars as much. Things are getting smaller, so they're going to want comfort. They're not going to, you know, want to wear heels. They're going to want things that transition easily. So she really sat down and kind of did this brain tree of what does athleisure look like? And of course, you know, here we are 2017 and it's one of the fastest growing fashion and year over year, it shows no sign of abating. So to me, that's an accurate forecast. And that was based on kind of our steep model. Again, it was these factors that came in. It wasn't her sitting in a room saying, you know, I really like linen pants for the office. You know, there's
is that what she sounds like?
Yeah, no, she's actually yeah. from Manchester, and her voice is amazing.
She's one of those British. Oh, like, she's just your advertising people.
The most
Northern
dedicated
British accents are amazing,
and the most amazing. It's like you want to talk about diehard sports fan. She everything. I mean, she lives and breathes it. She just
is she Man U or Man City?
You know, oh my gosh, she's gonna kill me. I don't know. Now you guys are going to get me beat up.
Don't guess it wrong.
I know. Now you're going to get me beat up.
That's serious business.
Oh, God. I don't know.
Is this
know
a forecast right now?
Yeah. I think
you're going to get beat up.
This is it.
So, okay. So that's interesting.
Black eyes are trending.
And then, like, with the.
We could take that so many places, guys. We'll leave that one alone.
That's up for the audience. They could do their own ideation.
Yeah.
So what is in this paper? In the sense that give us a tease of what you're going to be extracting.
I think basically what we're going to, you know, in terms of future proofing, I think what we're going to say is, you know, what are you actually doing in terms of what is your strategy for consumer engagement? You know, even the word consumer sometimes it's a difficult one. And more importantly, what are your white space opportunities? I mean, you know, retailers today, whether you're a fashion brand or a food brand, you know, everyone's sitting here and they want three things. They want certitude. Where am I going? Am I on the right track? They want validation. You're doing well.
Thank you.
Let's keep it going.
Thanks.
And the third one is they want a jumping off point. They want to know, you know, where do I go 2-3 years from now? So we kind of take it as a 1-3-5 approach. Just made up a new word. You know, what does 1 year look like? What is 3 and what is 5? And it's going to be kind of the secret sauce to that. You know, what can you do now that can impact your brand in 5 years? And do you have a strong visual language? Do you have an actual consumer roadmap? I cannot tell you how many people go, oh, we know our consumer. We know who we're talking to. Okay, great. Tell us a little bit about it. Share this information with us so we can figure what works for you, what communication strategy works for you. They're 20, 25 to 52. And they're on Facebook.
Hi, I'm Velvet Jones.
Yeah. They're everybody.
That guy had a good roadmap.
Yeah. No, but that's basically it. Or, you know, my favorite is, well, we know that they shop online.
That's fantastic.
So they're living.
Internet connected planet. Do they like breathing? Is that something they're interested? I mean, those are some of the things. And, you know, again, some of these brands are heritage brands, you know, very, very renowned brands. And I think with the great kind of retail apocalypse shifts, after 2008, you know, a lot of these brands couldn't rely on their icon anymore, their logo. They said, you know, we've got these disruptors coming in fast and furious. We've got direct to consumer brands that are killing it. So how do we stay relevant in that market? And that's what the white paper is going to kind of touch on.
When can we expect this?
When can you expect the white paper? I promise you guys we'll get it first.
Yes.
Yeah.
We love exclusives.
Yeah. We'll send it.
That's the perfect answer. Yeah. We'll get it first. But yeah.
As long as we get it first, that's all I'm concerned about. That's really what I was trying to ask, in a roundabout way, as if I was concerned about other people.
Only if you read it at your parents' house, though. I'm kind of put that addendum in there.
Okay. I can do that.
I want a photo of you. Okay, you're tapping it. Your family's going to be really upset right now.
It's fine.
You know, I have the new white paper, some saltfish and rice. Like, yeah, I'm going to be chilling. This is a good thing for me.
If there's saltfish and rice.
Success for me would be if you guys sent me an email and saying, okay, I'm not all for futurists, but I get what you guys do. That'd be a nice little landing spot for me.
Oh, yeah. We can say that now.
Yeah.
Futurists are whack, though.
Yeah.
What you guys do sounds a lot better. It's just
the term. Well, it can be a buzzword. I mean, I think the problem is a lot of people call themselves futurists, like I said, and it's more about kind of ideation.
It's like a guy with an annoying Twitter photo being like, I inspire and anticipate across the globe. Fuck you.
but he hasn't left a 3 mile radius and he couldn't hold his own and
I helped anticipate strategy.
Yeah, that accountability piece is a big piece for me.
I mean it's the whole thing is everyone's a creative now, right? So polymaths used to actually be a thing. You could be an expert in a real thing, and now you see the rise of hyphenate creatives. We all know them. I've got, five friends that are like, I'm an accountant by day, but I'm teaching yoga on Saturdays.
Yeah.
And it's that creative class, I think, that is moving and shifting too.
But polymaths used to write like really good books.
But it's really interesting because like polymath used to actually mean you were an expert in multi-fields.
Carl Polanyi was a polymath.
Yes, but hyphenate.
Now you're just someone interested in a few things.
Now you're someone who's just going to try to show me that you wrote a New Yorker article. Yeah. I'm in a real salty mood today.
Yeah.
But it's entertaining.
But I'm liking it. It's good. It's a healthy debate. Now I'll get an angry thing being like, but I am an accountant and do yoga. I'll get a tweet about that. Sorry about that.
Stick to one or the other.
Part of the creative class.
I don't take yoga classes from accountants. Sorry.
Yeah.
There it is.
That's on point. We'll be back next Tuesday with more Two Dope Boys.
Thank you.